Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast with me, your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia. And today my guest is Dr. Brannon Clater, joining me all the way from Pennsylvania in the United States. Dr. Clater obtained his undergraduate education at Colby College from Waterville in Maine, with a Bachelor of Arts and post-baccalaureate work from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. He remained on the ground in Philadelphia for medical school, attending Jefferson Medical College. He then tracked 46.54 degrees northeast to undertake basic science research at the Center for Platelet Function Studies and Vascular Surgery at the University of Massachusetts Medical School in Worcester, Massachusetts. He stayed there for his residency in surgery and plastic surgery fellowship, but requesting an even altitude, he headed into rarefied academic air on a heading of 261.57 degrees to complete a breast microsurgery and hand fellowship at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, Missouri, or as it's known there, WashU. After 10 years in private practice in New England, he returned to practice at his home field, the Philadelphia area, and he's been involved in academic teaching and medical political pursuits locally and nationally. In case the bizarre geographic and other references in my introduction are confusing, they pay respect to Brannon's qualifications as a pilot. His love of aviation is a passion I share, and in fact, we met through our shared interest. He's also into competitive sailing and, strangely for an American, cricket. So it's truly a pleasure to welcome Dr. Brannon Clater to the podcast.
Oh, thank you so very much, Jonathan. I'm very happy to be able to spend some time talking over our shared passions together.
Yeah, medicine and aviation. And let's start with that. Flying's in your blood. Your grandmother, I believe, flew Waco in the 1930s, right? She flew Wacos. You fly. All three brothers fly. How did you get into aviation?
Oh, you said it. My grandmother. When I was very young, going over to her farm to work in the summers, she would approach us and say, "Well, are you flying yet?" And I would say, "Well, Grandma, I can't even drive a car yet." She said, "Well, I'm not really interested in your excuses." And we all started flying at an early age. I believe I was 17 when I started flying. And the reason I can tell you I was that young is that I was driving a motorcycle back from my flying lesson, I believe when I was a senior in high school, maybe a freshman in college, I'm trying to remember. And a woman cut me off, and I was in a very unfortunate motorcycle accident. That time period sticks with me very clearly, but I believe I got my pilot's license by the time I was 19.
So, Brannon, when colorectal surgeons get together, we talk about strangest objects that we've removed from people's rectums. When pilots get together, we share our best flying stories. What's yours?
It has to be when I was flying a Cessna 172 from Philadelphia Northeast Airport back to Brandywine Airport. The plane I was flying had a engine that had a modification to it, and this valve or this, you know, whatever had been plugged came loose, and within about 30 seconds, all of the oil from the engine dumped out onto my windscreen. And believe this was probably 1989. And so the end of the story is that I was able to successfully navigate my way with a significant amount of help from air traffic control, be redirected back to Philadelphia Northeast Airport on a slowly dying engine as it was running out of oil, and able to land. And actually, I had to land by opening up the side window as I was being vectored in by air traffic control, telling me, you know, go this way, go that way, to get on the center line of the runway. But for the last 20 feet, I had to flare looking straight down at the runway because I had no forward visibility whatsoever.
Good on you. What a great achievement. I'll share my engine failure story with you when we next chat. Moving on, you worked as a fly fishing guide in Alaska, age 21. I adore Alaska, and I'm a keen but not very good fly fisherman. Tell us about that story.
I was extremely fortunate that my persistence paid off, because I this previous summer had worked pumping gas at an airport near Philadelphia, and so I had attained this skill, and I thought I could have a ticket to Alaska to work as a oil boy or gas pumping guy at a local airport in Alaska, just to get to Alaska to enjoy the outdoors. And as it turns out, there was an oil glut in the world at the time, and so the economy of Alaska was kind of on the skids. And this was in 1987, I believe. And so I'm cold calling airports to say, hey, can I, you know, come work for you pumping gas? And every one of them, and I'm literally in the college dorm pouring quarters into the phone, you know, calling all these airports. And they were all saying, no, no, no. Finally, this one guy said, listen, you sound like a nice guy. Do you know how to fish? And, you know, I'd been raised to fly fish by my father and mother. And I said, yeah. He said, well, look, I take care of these airplanes for this guy in this winter, and he's always looking for college kids to be his fly fishing guides. Why don't you call him? So I did. His name was Ray Loche, and he ran the Rainbow King Lodge. And I dialed him up, and I said, hello, Mr. Loche. You know, this is me, and, you know, I'd like to come work for you. And I told him how I'd gotten his name. This was the job interview. He goes, so do you know how to fish? I said, yes, sir. He said, do you know how to work outboard motors? Well, growing up on a farm, I had learned how to, you know, strip carburetors down and work on engines. And I said, yes, sir. And he goes, good. Be here June 1st. That was my job interview. So they intentionally wanted people who were, I guess the term is green, that he brought us up there and trained us how to fish for the first week. And that was his way of controlling and delivering a really great product for the fishermen that came up as the guests. And so it was an absolute dream for me.
You know, some people may wonder, hang on a second, this is supposed to be an interview with a surgeon. Well, I think it's really important that people understand the richness of life that's to be had. And I think as physicians, if we have a more rounded life, we can be more understanding and more helpful to our patients and more encouraging. Would you concur with that?
Absolutely. I actually got interviewed by my plastic surgery society last year. They heard that I had a history of fly fishing, and they said, look, we really want to do a story on you and how fly fishing has influenced your career development in plastic surgery. And I said, actually, there are tremendous similarities. You learn manual dexterity tying flies. You learn patience by standing at the river and studying the flow of the water and studying what flies you're going to use and how you're going to present them. And it's not too dissimilar to planning for a very complex rhinoplasty operation and making sure that you have all the elements in place, you have all the proper equipment, and that you have your team well-schooled for the objective. So there are tremendous similarities.
And, you know, I always think of Atul Gawande's marvelous book, Complications. And
yep.
I feel like I have to say that he wrote the book that I should have written. He did a much better job than I could have ever done. But any of my residents who were to hear this would go, yeah, that's right. I used to bang onto them ad nauseum about how doing a surgical procedure was like a flight, and you hang a fly at first, don't you? You work out where you're going to go, you check the weather, you make sure that you have all the data, and you're constantly staying ahead of the airplane and working out what you need to do if this happens or that. And just like when you're doing a surgical operation, what's the worst possible thing that could happen if I make an incision here, right? So I like your thinking. So let's drill down into your career. I recall that you told me you were initially keen on vascular or cardiac surgery. What took you into plastics, and what do you enjoy about the discipline?
Absolutely. I started out in cardiothoracic research even before I went to medical school, and I was very passionate about the most demanding field that you could possibly get into in medicine. And I looked at cardiothoracic surgery and vascular surgery as those fields. I just aspired to the most challenging thing that you could possibly think about. And I did a lot of research. And as you mentioned in my introduction, very kindly, I did 2 years of basic science research in the middle of my residency studying platelet physiology to try and better understand the pathophysiology of vascular disease. And I feel it has tremendously helped me in my ability to be a good clinician as well as academician. And it was when I was in the research lab doing all this basic science research that I was given the opportunity to go to Ecuador and participate with the plastic surgery team. And mostly what we were doing is fixing cleft lip and palates for people who really had no access to medical care. And I was so inspired by this that it motivated me to pivot from vascular surgery to plastic surgery. So that's the origin of the dive into plastic surgery.
I mean, there's no doubt, I'm familiar with some of the groups that do these mission trips. There's no doubt that helping a kid who's got a hair lip or a cleft palate and fixing that, changing the quality of their life, their self-esteem, the way they fit into their family, nutritional aspects. It, you know, I guess in plastics, that must be one of the most rewarding thing. I know that you've continued to do that kind of trip, like through Rotary International, you did a similar trip to Bangladesh. Has that been, that's been like an enduring thing in your life?
Absolutely. I love it. It is so rewarding to be able to take my skill set and apply it to those who really have no access to this. And so this was, my last trip was about 4 years ago, and it was, as you correctly mentioned, with Rotary International. And it's actually called Rotoplast. And we went out as a team of 40 people, three surgeons, three anesthesiologists, several pediatricians, about a dozen nurses. And we took absolutely everything, 40 humongous boxes for 2 weeks over to Bangladesh. And it was so incredibly rewarding to help people who look at healthcare as a totally different perspective than we see in this country. You know, the ward, I think, had 40 beds, and every family was given a bed. And so a family would travel an enormous distance, sometimes days, to come to the hospital for the procedure. And the whole family would live at the bed. Generally, the parents would sleep on the floor under the bed while the child slept in the bed. And it was, we'd go on rounds in the morning, and it was this incredible mass of humanity, just so eager for our input to help them achieve a life-changing operation. And so, yes, incredibly rewarding.
Well, good on you for doing that. And as we live through this pandemic, there've been statements about, I think from the World Health Organization, talking about a state of moral bankruptcy if the better off nations don't help the worse off nations. Human suffering is human suffering is human suffering. So another aspect of working in medicine is teaching. I've always found that teaching, whether it's residents, colleagues, or the lay public, it keeps us honest, demanding that we do know more than those we're mentoring. And I know that you've been a keen and very well-respected teacher. How does it float your boat?
Thank you so much for asking that very important question. As a physician in private practice, any teaching that I do is something that I do basically as a volunteer, investing my time in teaching either medical students or family residents or plastic surgery residents, or even for that matter, I'm in charge of teaching the breast surgeons the finer points about plastic surgery, wound closure, and techniques at our breast center. But you're absolutely right. It is extremely rewarding to me to share my experiences and my thoughts with those who are passionate about medicine and hungry and eager to learn as much as they possibly can.
Yeah, as I say, it does keep you honest. You know, when you are preparing to give a talk to young doctors or nurses or whatever, even the lay public, there's that moment of terror just before you start. Oh my goodness, are they going to ask a question that I can't answer? And you know what? If they do, that great answer, I don't know. But the next time we speak, I will know. So let's switch and talk about your practice. Of all the work you do as a plastic surgeon, what are the procedures that give you the most personal satisfaction?
I think there are two groups of surgical procedures that I find that I have pioneered a significant amount of. One is the abdominoplasty, or the lay people would call a tummy tuck. It's an operation that many patients are seeking to achieve a more contoured abdomen that helps them achieve that, if you will, prior body image, often before they had children. And sometimes this is even referred to as the mommy makeover. But we all need to understand that most of these patients are seeking an aesthetic result to achieve a goal that matches their self-body image, meaning they eat well, they exercise, and as a sequela of childbirth, they have significant abdominal wall laxity, loose skin, and adipose tissue, or which is another term for fat, in areas that are just refractory to any kind of exercise or diet. And so understanding that patients are seeking this out, we want to help them achieve the safest and the most optimal results. And so I've been lucky enough to lecture on this for the last 10 or 11 years at our national and even international forums about how to do this not using drains. And it's a really pioneering concept, which I've been very proud of.
Well, I'd like to come on and talk about the drain work in a minute, but first of all, for you know those folks listening who may refer someone who is in that situation, eating well, exercising, just can't get rid of that last bit of flab, and it affects their self-confidence. When is liposuction appropriate, and when is an abdominoplasty, actually resecting an ellipse of skin and underlying tissue? How do you make that decision?
It's very easy. Basically, it boils down to skin laxity. If they have soft tissue that is mostly fat, then liposuction is an excellent option. If they have loose fat but also loose skin, then that means that liposuction is going to be inadequate to tighten that skin, and therefore a tummy tuck or an abdominoplasty procedure is the optimal treatment.
Very helpful. You are all constantly talking about women there having this, but it's not just women, it's men. And in fact, we typically think of plastic surgery, not post-cancer resection reconstruction work, but aesthetic work, as being something women probably seek more. But is that the case? And let's stress, you do not practice in Beverly Hills. You're practicing on the East Coast in the Philadelphia area.
I'm glad you asked about men. I was actually interviewed by NPR about 3 years ago. And they came to me and they said, hey, we understand that there's this huge increase in men. Can you explain it? So I actually dug into my own data, because I too thought that most of my patients were women. And as it turns out, I had a very large segment of patients that were men. And then we further subdivided them into three categories. And we found that there were three categories of men. And I'll start with the smallest number first, and that is men who had been not reporting their age, and they were approaching a certain age where it was becoming more and more obvious. And these may be CEOs or people of running corporations, and they didn't want to retire. So they needed to look younger so that they could continue looking strong and relevant. The second group were gay men who were very motivated for their appearance. But interestingly, the third group, which wound up being the largest group of men, which was very fascinating to me, turned out to be either husbands or boyfriends of one of my female patients. And what I came to realize is that men are terrified of asking for help to improve their aesthetics. I have this skit that I want to do for Saturday Night Live, and it kind of goes like this, that your typical female patient gets up in the morning, looks in the mirror, and she just goes, oh my goodness, this is not right, and, you know, puts their fingers on their cheeks and lifts up. But your typical man gets up in the morning and looks in the mirror, and he kind of looks back and forth and starts smiling. He goes, I kind of look like, you know, Mel Gibson. And then I go one step further, that a woman will call the office and talk to my patient care coordinator and say, hi, you know, this is Joan. I'm very upset about how my face is looking, you know, deflated, and I need to come in and see Dr. Plater for a facelift. And they'll be like, okay, no problem. A typical man will call in and go like this. Hello? Hi, yes, what can I help you with? Can't even verbalize why they're so upset. So they come in and they sit there and they watch me interact with their wife or their girlfriend, and they realize that it's not scary. It's easy to have a conversation with me. And almost universally, what will happen is the patient will go with one of my nurses to get their pictures taken in the photo room, and I'll stay in the examining room with the husband. And the minute the wife leaves, he'll turn to me and he'll go, can you fix my man boobs? So, yes, it is a growing part of plastic surgery that men are looking for aesthetic rejuvenation.
There you go. So, let's go a slightly younger age and the issue of counseling. So, many years ago, a young woman, very young, I don't know, 18, 19, came to see me, and the referral letter just stated breast problem. When I asked her, she said that she wanted breast enhancements. And I told her that this wasn't something I did. And, you know, I could refer her to one of my colleagues. But she asked me to examine her anyway. And to my medical eye, she was perfectly normal. Turns out that it was her boyfriend who wanted her to have larger breasts. And perhaps rather naughtily, I suggested that she get a new boyfriend, not new breasts. And, you know, having a surgical procedure to assuage someone else's perceptions was really not on. So what sort of counseling would you do before embarking on a procedure? And let's take that as an example, because it's quite a common procedure.
You're absolutely right. There are probably over 300,000 breast augmentation procedures performed in the United States alone. And obviously worldwide, it's significantly larger. You're touching on two topics here, and I'd like to pull them apart. One is a condition called body dysmorphic disorder, or BDD. And then the other one is motivation. Where is the motivation for any kind of aesthetic rejuvenation or aesthetic procedure coming from? And as you could probably tell from my conversational style with you today, that's what I like to do. I like to sit and talk and spend a fair amount of time getting to know the patient and asking them what they're interested in and what it is that their goals and objectives are. And a fair amount of the time that I spend with them is trying to help them understand what's possible and then me to understand what their motivations are so that I can match their expectations with what's possible. I do like to have family members in during a consultation so that there are multiple sets of ears hearing what I'm saying. I often repeat several times what some of the objectives might be so that they can tell me and then I can verbalize back to them what they're looking for. With this Instagram generation that we're seeing, there are younger and younger people seeking aesthetic procedures, and the social norms of younger and younger people achieving or seeking out these procedures is something that's more and more commonplace. And we need to understand that patients have certain motivations and that sometimes they may have significant breast asymmetry. I've had young 16-year-old women come with significant breast asymmetry, and it is just heartbreaking. They can't change in the locker room and without feeling embarrassed. And so those are areas where at a young age, that kind of operation may be entertained. Otherwise, it often those are the kinds of patients at the young, tender age of young adulthood that more counseling is helpful. And I've been very successful having access to a wonderful woman who I can put patients in touch with who can help them better understand what their objectives are and look at it from a therapy perspective as well. And so it's not simply a role of a technician. There's a significant component of interpersonal relationships that help achieve the patient's best results.
You know, I think it's very gratifying to hear that kind of approach and that highly personalized and highly personal. And the comment about having other people there, because, you know, what's the old line that patients remember roughly one fifth of what they've been told at a consultation. So that's very important. You mentioned this earlier. You mentioned about drains. And in medicine, we tend to do things because that's how we've always done things rather than due to any data. Changing firmly held belief systems in medicine, such as your work during surgery without drains, is one such example. What was your inspiration for doing that work? And has it been widely accepted in your discipline?
My inspiration for trying to move away from drains came out of a patient having a complication from a drain. And you're absolutely right. We were all trained to use drains, closed suction drainage. And when you think about it, it makes sense. There's a significant amount of surgical dissection in doing a abdominoplasty. You're literally opening up almost their entire abdominal wall from where their bikini line would be all the way up to their rib cage. And so there's a very large potential space that someone could accumulate fluid into and develop what's called a seroma. So the conventional or the traditional training would be to put in drains to suction out that fluid. And those drains would exit the patient either from the lateral hip or down in the groin area. I personally find the groin area to be a painful consideration. And so I never even considered that I would have the drains come out from the lateral hip. But this one patient walked through a doorway, and you can imagine that drain looping out, and it got caught on a doorknob and it accidentally pulled. And even though we suture them in, you can imagine, right? And
that's awful.
You know, you having done a lot of surgery, you can completely sympathize with the pain and discomfort. And it only was compounded when she took the drain. And even though they have access to me to call me, and this was about 15 years ago, she took it and pushed the drain back in again. Oh. And obviously the concern there is then bacteria was introduced to the wound. She developed an infection, which mercifully healed up with minimal issues, but it was so problematic. It inspired me to think, you know, how can this be done differently? And there are a lot of people who have pioneered understanding the abdominal wall anatomy better. And one of those techniques is to preserve your internal lymphatic system in a certain layer of your abdominal wall called the scarpus fascia. And so by preserving a portion of scarpus fascia, you literally preserve a component of your internal lymphatics. And great research has shown that about 20% of the abdominal wall lymphatics, and lymphatics are something that drain fluid normally from you. So if you're able to preserve that tissue, then you preserve the body's own sump pump. And so by doing that maneuver and several other finesse moves along the way, because it's not any one thing, it's a combination of things, but that's one of the big ones. The second one, second biggest, is probably something called progressive tension sutures, where sutures are literally sutured to the underside of the abdominal wall and then down to the muscle to close off that open space. And that's yet another technique that really helps and minimizes fluid accumulation. And so combining those, I've been able to avoid using drains for the last 10 years. And my complication rate or my rate of developing a situation...
like a seroma, for instance.
Thank you. I was trying to come up with a lay term for this, but fluid accumulation underneath the abdominal flap, that someone would say, oh, if you'd had a drain in, that wouldn't have happened. My incidence of that is about 1/10 of the published literature out there. So I'm achieving significant avoidance of that complication by not using drains, which is very almost counterintuitive.
Yeah, I sometimes wonder when there are maneuvers like that, do people place an undue reliance on them to prevent a complication? And there are parallels in flying, right? We've got these fancy computers in the cockpits of our aircraft now. That does not mean that you shouldn't take off the fuel cap before you start up and taxi and check that there's fuel in the bloody tanks, right? The fact that you've got the fancy gauge does not preclude doing the good, simple steps. So tell me, what do you think the future might hold for plastic surgery?
Well, certainly less and less invasive type procedures is what patients are clamoring for. And so just like, you know, if you rely on a pilot who has tremendous experience with all forms of aviation, moving into, you know, let's say, you know, non-combustion engine and electric powered engines, you need to make sure that they have a very good grounding in aviation before you move into the innovation. And innovation, I would almost like to make my new middle name. I mean, I love innovation. I understand that putting a lot of effort into understanding what limitations are in innovation are important, but I'm also very motivated to see increases in innovation. And probably one of the most fascinating innovations that have come out recently is something called the Elevate suture, or they actually call it My Elevate, because I think the word Elevate was probably already taken. And that's literally a suture that is used to suspend and tighten the neck. And especially in this era of everybody being on Zoom, everyone's looking at their neck and terrified by how it looks. And so, but this is a percutaneous, which means making a very small incision to deploy this threaded suture to redrape and contour the neck. And, you know, we don't get to these innovation points without pushing the envelope. And pushing the envelope requires really understanding how to do it, if you will, in the more open technique. And so that's certainly one of the big innovations.
Interesting. So I was just reflecting on your comment about people being terrified by their necks. I mean, I think standards are slipping. The many good memes during this wretched time. My favorite one is 9 p.m., time to change from my daytime pajamas to my nighttime pajamas. So, Brandon, I like to ask all my guests some version of this question. If you awoke tomorrow to discover that you're in charge of healthcare for the world, and you're a guy that's been involved, you've got a very broad frame of reference, you've traveled overseas, you provided mission surgery, and for that, you know, thank you and bless you for that. What three things would you do?
Well, again, let's make sure we reframe the question so that there's no confusion about what I'm going to say. And that is, you were suggesting, what can we do for the healthcare for the world? So you're really talking public healthcare policy and recognizing that a significant portion of the world lives in poverty, and basic healthcare with access to clean water and basic medical supplies could save untold millions more than any new surgical robot could. I certainly think supporting the different nonprofit groups that are able to go into third world countries and provide clean water and basic immunizations. And we talked earlier about Rotary. One of Rotary's real focuses is the polio vaccination, to try and get everyone in the world vaccinated against polio. And I'm sure that, you know, in this current era of COVID, trying to get everybody vaccinated for COVID will also be a very important healthcare initiative. And so I would say allowing and supporting those nonprofit organizations to be able to move and support patients' populations where they have less access to medical care would be the number one initiative.
We've got to have you back. And you and I have to get together to talk more about flying airplanes, medicine, medical politics, teaching, research, education, providing patient services, and cricket, because we didn't get to that. Brandon Clayter, Dr. Brandon Clayter, thank you so much for being with us today.
Jonathan, it was truly my pleasure, and I look forward to our next installment.
Absolutely. Well, folks, that's it for today. I hope you've enjoyed this discussion as much as I have. And if so, please tell your friends about the podcast, like us on social media, and feel free to email me at drjonathansakhier@gmail.com. That's Dr. DrJonathanSakhier, drjonathansakhier@gmail.com, if you've got any suggestions on topics you want me to cover. And remember, please listen in next Friday to the EMG Health Podcast. Until then, all the best, and bye for now.